loving Heavenly Father, we thank you, Lord, for your loving grace to us, the Lord Jesus. We bow before you, eternal God, inhabitant of eternity. Lord, just instruct our hearts tonight, encourage us in the ways of the Lord and in your word. And, O Lord, do teach us your ways, we do pray, so that we can live for you and your glory, in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thanks, Ron. Over to you, Paul.
Here we go. We are looking at Samson. And I like Samson. I think he's a great guy. Mm-hmm. You know, some, when you listen to sermons about Samson, you can see that it presents itself really well. And, you know, when you read this, it's very clear who he is. He's a man of faith. Except that most sermons present him not as the man of faith. They are more talking about his waywardness, about his incredible strength, his cunning, but not his faith. But for this he is commended in Hebrews 11. The other problem that I have with it is that most of the sermons present him as a Hulk, as a he-man, as some kind of a strong man. But the reality is he wasn't. There's nothing to indicate that he was strong. All paintings, picture books, you know, movies, all present him as this incredible man who brought by himself the temple down of Dagon in his own strength. But even the godless lords of the Philistines recognized that Samson had no strength. And therefore they asked Delilah, seduce him and see where his great strength lies. Judges 16, verse 3. And so, you'll forgive me, I think he looks more like me without a beard rather than the Hulk, as we often present him. But the other thing that we do in Christian sermons is that we compare him to Jesus. Now, I get that. But if we present anybody next to Jesus, they never come out good. It's true that Samson defiled himself by touching a dead carcass of a lion, Judges 14:8. He omitted the truth about the honey to his parents in the next verse, Judges 14:9. Samson set fire and destroyed the fields of grain and vineyards and olive groves, Judges 15:5. Samson disobeyed God in many ways, you know, throughout the chapters of 14 and 15. And Samson killed thousands of people with the jawbone of a donkey. And it's true, in typical sermons, they make Samson look bad and Jesus look good. You know, Jesus cleansed people. He spoke the truth. He did not destroy, but he used it to feed people, thousands of people. He obeyed God, not my will, but your will. He gave life to others. The problem is that we don't present the man of faith that he is. And it's true, but if you put my name in there instead of Samson, or perhaps you'll be willing to recognize yourself in that, then you too would not come out looking like or smelling like roses. It's just the way it is. Oops. But Samson was a man of faith, there's no doubt about it, a man of great faith, because he's recognized next to people like Enoch and Abraham, Sarah and Moses. And by faith they gained approval, as Hebrews 11:32 says so clearly, who by faith conquered, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions. And so the least we can say is that he shut the mouths of lions, but possibly more. Maybe acts of righteousness in that God recognized what he did. So there is much more to Samson than we would like it to be. And so if you, like me, I hope you'll be able to rejoice in what Samson did when he wreaked havoc amongst the Philistines. At the same time, we can wonder and ponder how it is possible that he is a hero of the faith. One man who's dedicated from birth, yet does the foolish thing by marrying a Philistine and sleeping with prostitutes and allowing the Philistine temptress to deceive him time and time and time again. Yeah, they're good questions to ponder, but I think it's helpful to really ponder the text so that we don't get sidetracked by movie hermeneutics or sermon that have been preached. There are three kinds of judges that acted like warriors: Gideon, Ehud, Shamgar, Samson. Judges who acted like priests: Eli, who judged Israel for 40 years, and Samuel, who judged all the days of his life. And then there are judges who are just prophets: Deborah, the prophetess, and Samuel, the prophet. So there are clear distinctions between them. Samson is clearly the warrior judge, and he's often seen as somebody who is not that bright, because all he's known for is his strength. But he uses workplace throughout his encounters, so he is a little bit more than just a strong man. Now, Samson and Jephthah are contemporaries. They follow one another in quick succession. But where the story of Jephthah concerns itself with the middle of the country, Samson is occupied by the area of what today is called the Gaza envelope, but the Gaza Strip. And he is there for quite a while. So it's helpful to place him in that right segment. The story of Samson is from chapter 13 to chapter 16, and a simple outline would be really the miraculous birth in chapter 13. And it's important because Samson's miraculous birth connects him to barren women and a man who is prophesied to come by God. So there's a similarity to the birth of Samuel the prophet, and even beyond that, that he is one who's foretold his birth. In chapter 14 and chapter 15, there's the Timnite woman and Samson's revenge. And then the final part, the final act in his story, is Samson and the prostitute in Delilah in chapter 16. So it comes in parts. But the first section that we would encounter him in is at Timnah. Now, Timnah is part of the Gaza envelope, and this is under Philistine control. It's from here that we see the various cities of the Gaza Strip, as we would call it today. And the Philistines also controlled the Shephelah, the lowlands, the valleys and the plains, or the lowlands. So between the coast and the Judean hills. So the Judean hills are Hebron going up to Jerusalem. So that section, it's a very small section. But the Philistines controlled all of the coastal plain across into the plain of Jezreel at the top towards Beit Shan. Now, in chapter 14, Act 1, if you like, there's the slaying of the lion on his journey to Timnah. Samson's powerful skill with the lion, where he tears it apart with his bare hands. And there's the slaughter for the riddle that then follows, and to fulfill his wages after the riddle is solved, Samson strikes down 30 Philistines, takes their garments as payments. We then come to the second part of this story, which is the retaliation and revenge. Because he doesn't get the woman he wants, there's the burning of the Philistine crops. And his wife being given over to another is that whole judgment that he then brings onto the Philistines in Judges 15, 1-5. It's a great slaughter. And Samson inflicts such a massive defeat upon the Philistines including the burning of his father-in-law, and for the giving of the way of his wife, and so he burns the father-in-law. Then it's a demonstration of his strength, the breaking of the bond, and that's what most sermons focus on, when he's handed over by his own people, but Samson keeps breaking free of the various cords. And then there's the jawbone by which he strikes the people. Now there's therefore three major acts, or you could divide up into six smaller parts, and that will help you see this story clearly, and it's helpful to understand that. Now the Philistines, who are at this point in control of the coastal land, are in control. That it's because Israel did evil. We saw that in Judges 13, verse 1. So the Lord gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. So it's one of those long cycles. That's an entire generation that had not walked with the Lord. Now there are faithful people within it, but by and large, they didn't. Now the Philistines who are in control are not the people who live there today, the Palestinians. They're not related. Philistine come from the word invaders. These are the people who invaded from the Greek Isles. The Greek Isles are Kaftor, Crete, possibly even Greek islands themselves. So at the time that Abraham dwelt in the land, to the time of Moses, at some stage during that period, they came into the land. Now the Palestinian people today, are of Arab descent, so they're not related. Now the Philistines back then were nasty people. They were brutal people. And they threatened to kill Samson and his wife, and for a small debt. And they said in Judges 14, "We will burn you and your father's house with fire." There was no empty threat. We know from ancient writings that they did this more often. In response, what we see is that Samson inflicted a greater and a bigger cost on them. And in chapter 15, verse 6, we read, "The Philistines came upon and burned her and her father's house." He then responds with a much greater force to them. But it was no idle threat. They did this on a more regular basis. The Philistines were not a backward people. In fact, they had superior weapons. They had iron, while Israel is still in the Bronze Age. So it's that overlapping. And they had a monopoly on iron manufacturing and iron sharpening. If you look at 1 Samuel 13, verses 19 to 22, you see that Israel needs to go to them to get iron made for them. So they're clearly not able to do this. And so their iron, clearly harder, tougher, and stronger than bronze, is a great advantage. They have chariots. Now, because of the lowlands, the coastal plains, they're able to, with their chariots, able to control vast parts of the land. Now the coastal strip goes all the way into Egypt. All the way from there, you can ride almost to Damascus without great trouble, just by going across the valleys. And so having the coastal plain and the Jezreel Valley will be a great asset to them. So here they hold on to the lowlands, the Shvilah, as it is called biblically. And it means that they are continual pest towards Israel. But having the coastal land also means that they control one of the major trade routes, which means money is coming in. They control the Via Maris, or the way of the sea, the major route that connects from Egypt all the way to Babylon. And so from here, you would travel from Egypt, Hierapolis, in the left-hand corner, just probably above me, up to Gaza. And then from Gaza, you would scoot across to Petra and then to Babylon through either the way of the Nabataeans, or you would go up towards the north and do Damascus, and then go up to Nineveh and then come south. So they control a major portion of the finance that are coming through here. And the VMR is key in this area. Now, their dominance means also not just a control of an economic highway, but also their military dominance indicates that they have a bigger presence throughout the land. And so in the days of King Saul, the Philistines strategically controlled this area, and they have garrisons throughout the land, 1 Samuel 10, verse 5. And so Saul really needs to clash with them and to force them back to the coastal plain. It's not until the time of King David that there are victories over the Philistines, 2 Samuel 5, 17 to 28, and 2 Samuel 8. And even then, they remain a pest. Now, on the other side of the land, there's the King's Highway, but they have very little to do with that. But that's the area, the King's Highway, where Jephthah is. And so these two stories both happen on the trade route. And so these are highly significant. Now, Samson's parents, in Judges 13, encounter the angel of the Lord. And we've mentioned him briefly before, but today seems like a good day to play a little bit with that. We're introduced to Manoah and his wife. They belong to the tribe of Dan, one of the smallest tribes in Israel. They have no kids. When the angel of the Lord appeared to them with a promise of a child. I spoke a little bit about this when we did Gideon, the judge. But the angel of the Lord forgives sin, and he acts as, and he speaks as God. So while he is seen as a man, he's seen as an angel, he's addressed as God, because he's part of that triunity, the Trinity. He is the God-man made manifest. Now, here are some other references. The angel of the Lord speaks and acts as God, but one good example would be Genesis 32, where Jacob is wrestling with a man who's identified as God in that same chapter, but who's identified as the angel in Hosea 12:4. So here too, we shouldn't see it just as an angel. When it talks about the angel of the Lord, it is always the second person of the Trinity. Now, in this case, we see it very strongly, because the angel of the Lord said unto him, "Why do you ask after my name, seeing it's a secret?" Now, that's the King James translation, it's a secret. The Jewish Publication Society, the JPS, that's a Jewish translation, renders that word as hidden, seeing that my name is hidden. The New American has seen it is wonderful. And so various translations translate the word secret, hidden, wonderful, all from the same kind of root. But the Hebrew word here is related to the word pele, and the form here is pele. And in Isaiah 9, verse 6, you will remember it, his name shall be called Pele Yoetz, Wonderful Counselor. And so here too, we must see that this is one of those significant names where we can clearly see that this is the God-man. Now, in Isaiah, that phrase, the wonderful counselor, is only used of God. So here too, it indicates that it is God himself who's in the picture. And so while at this point, yes, his name is secret, yes, his name is hidden, there's the underlying truth, there's no doubt about that, but he is the wonderful one, and again pointing towards that divine, the God-man identification. Now in verses 15 to 20, Manoah asks the angel to wait while they prepare a meal. So Manoah, in verse 19, takes a kid, a small goat, with a meat offering, and offered it upon the rock unto the Lord. And the angel did wonderfully or wondrously, and that's that same kind of wording. And Manoah and his wife looked on. And here we have that same word, pele, that is being used. And by bringing fire out of a rock, something that cannot happen unless you are God, and consuming the flesh of the goat and the grain offering, it's indicating here too very strongly that he is not just an angel. He is doing wondrously, something only God could do. And so it's a clear confirmation that this angel is the angel of the Lord, and he is the unique God-man. So in verse 21, the angel of the Lord put out the end of his staff that was in his hand, and he touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and the fire sprang up from the rock, consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. Then the angel of the Lord vanishes from his sight. Now this reads similar to what have happened in chapter 13, verse 20, when it came to pass when the flame went up towards heaven from the altar, that the angel of the Lord ascended into the flame of altar, and Manoah and his wife looked upon it and fell on their faces to the ground. And they understood, Manoah and his wife, that this is the Lord, and that he had accepted their sacrifice. And so they understand that this angel is not just a messenger of God. They recognize it was the Lord himself who spoke. And so while the nation as a whole is not walking with the Lord, we do see the remnant. And Manoah and his wife are part of that remnant. And in every generation is a remnant. How big that is always difficult to, to state. But it's clear that there is a remnant. Now this angel, when he had spoken, he's referred to as a man, Isha Elohim, the man of God. But it's clear that he's also the Malach Elohim, the angel of God, or the angel of God. And so it's that clear indication that he is not just a man. Now the angel of the Lord said to Manoah that his son should be a Nazarite. Now, a Nazir, comes from the word to consecrate, is a consecrated one. He's consecrated unto God. Now, often that happened for a period of time. The tribe of Levi is a Nazirite tribe as a whole. They're consecrated unto God. But here it is clear that it's usually for a period of time. And so the Nazir would come, take upon himself a voluntary vow, separate himself or herself to God for some period of time. And you find the laws of the Nazarite in the book of Numbers, chapter 6, verses 1 to 21. Now, Samson is different. He is called to be a Nazarite from birth. So, from the moment he is born, he is not to drink wine or produce or have grape products or anything that is alcoholic in that sense, and he's not allowed to be in contact with the dead. If he does, he should shave his head and start again. And so there's some strict laws there how to behave. Now with Samson, it's slightly different. He's dead from life. And that's interesting because his story is, in that sense, there's parallels to the life of Jesus. In Judges 13, verse 24, the woman, that's Manoah's wife, gave birth to a son and named him Samson. And the child grew up and the Lord blessed him. Now, Samson is the only person who's directly blessed by the Lord in this book. And so while other judges experience God's favor through the fig trees and they get communication, but directly blessed, and the Lord blessed him, is unique. We see this kind of language twice more. Once with Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 19, where the child grew up and the Lord blessed him, talking about Samuel. And we see it with the life of Jesus in Luke chapter 1, verse 18, and the child grew up and the Lord blessed him. So all of these three are set apart by God. Now, Jesus, we get that. Samuel will go, yes, he's a good guy. But most of us throw out unfortunately, Samson, and I think that's a bit of a pity, because he does demonstrate in his life to be the man of faith, even though he also neglects it and he is faithless at times. But he stands in contrast to the nation at large, who is totally faithless. And both of them stand in a sharp contrast to God, who is always faithful. So, there you go. Now, the next rite is to abstain from wine, to abstain from cutting hair, and from touching anything dead. Now, it doesn't specify animals, but that's the implication. Now, there are only three people that are lifelong Nazarites: Samson, Samuel, and John the Baptist. Samuel and John the Baptist are usually said to be faithful in their calling, while Samson, it's often stated he is unfaithful. And so he is to be set apart. We see that this whole section of the Nazarite vow from the book of Numbers, chapter 6, 1 to 21, we see that explained in Judges 13, 4 to 5. But therefore be careful not to drink wine, strong drink, eat unclean foods. It's a little bit extended here. Behold, you are to conceive and give birth to a son. No razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines. And so this clearly is a very important character. Now, not to drink strong drinks or unfermented wines, grape juice, fresh and dried grapes, any of that is out. And it really indicates separation from the world, because drinking wine was as common then as drinking water is today. Now, the not cutting of the hair, men usually had short hair, long hair was considered a bad thing, and so unshorn hair, a symbol of consecration unto God. And then no contact with the dead, not even for a close relative, and so father, mother, brother, sister, and it would require purity. It emphasizes that whole consecrated purity during this period unto the living God. And these people had died, so there was to be no contact. Now, there are people who make a temporary Nazarite vow, and most of them are not mentioned in the Bible, but there is one group that is mentioned, not by name, but the Apostle Paul does pay for them in Acts 18, verse 18. Once the Nazarite vow was completed, they would either go to the temple or the tabernacle earlier on, chapter 6, verse 13, and they would offer various things like a lamb without blemish, a year old, a ewe lamb without blemish for a sin offering, a ram for a peace offering, and unleavened cakes. And so there was this specific offering to be made, and this was to be together with a peace offering. And so it was now that reconciliation had been made with God through that peace, and after their breaking of the vow. Now, there are other people who take the vow, but it's not clear. And so, for instance, Absalom, the son of David, he took a yearly Nazarite vow, 2 Samuel 14:26. Now, whether he actually did or didn't, I think he did, but I'll leave that for you. Certainly in Jewish tradition, in the writings of the sages, it says that he would have a Nazarite vow. And so that it's something that I see there. Now, did Samson, was he faithful? Well, he moved through the vineyards, Judges 14:5. Did he partake of it at that point? Possibly, but it doesn't seem to be. However, he did hope you can't hear that. My neighbor's just turning on the blower. He did, together with his friends, his 30 Philistine friends, hold on to a drinking feast. And that would indicate for a wedding feast in some translations, but it really is a drinking party. And so there it certainly is indicated that he compromised his stand. Now, was he in contact with the dead? Well, it doesn't say anything about dead people, that's true, except for those that he's slain. And there were 30 Philistines in Ashkelon, Judges 14. The many Philistines for burning his wife and his father-in-law, Judges 15:8. And the 1,000 Philistines that he killed with the jawbone of a donkey, Judges 15, verses 15, 14 and 15. And the great multitude, obviously, when he also died at the Temple of Dagon, chapter 16, verses 27 to 30. Because those are in war time, some believe it was okay, others don't. He also came in contact with dead animals. And that's not a violation per se, the lion's carcass, Judges 14, verses 8 and 9, and the donkey, because Samson killed the donkey too with his bare hands, Judges 15, verses 15 to 16. And the other thing, he did cut his hair while he let it. He cut his hair shaved in Judges 16, by Delilah. So, in the most positive way, we could certainly say he kept none of them. That's the reality. He did break it, and it does show his lack of conviction in that way. But he is in a state of profound separateness and devotion to God, though he did not keep himself ritually pure. He does seem to pray, and so in that sense, it isn't all that, it is bad, but it's that there's elements of faith in his life. That's all I'm trying to indicate. Now, the other thing he did, and this is part of that separation from the world, he married a Philistine woman of Timnah, and that's clearly breaking that vow of separating unto God, the Nazarite part, the separation. And he visited prostitutes, and again, that's in Judges 16, and that goes against the spirit of the vow, purification, devotion, holiness. All of that is thrown out at that point. And finally, his most famous encounter is with Delilah. And though the Bible doesn't call Delilah his wife, they certainly seem to have a romantic relationship at best. And so again, there too, there is the defiling of his state as a Nazir. Now, Samson is clearly aware of his status as a Nazirite, because he doesn't tell for a long time Delilah his secret. Eventually, she breaks him, and he does tell her. And so, there is a moral lesson within this, and it's written in Psalm 82. Asaph, who writes that, he says, "They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk in darkness." And Samson rejects knowledge and understanding of God, because the tabernacle is standing, he is dedicated, his parents are part of the remnant. He knows of what has been said over him. He leans on the immense strength that he gets. The Spirit of the Lord is upon him and begun to stir him up at Machane Dan. And yet he lives as if he doesn't care. In other words, he walks in darkness. Now, Machane Dan is between Zora and Eshtol. Judges 13:25 states that. And again, that's the edge of the lowlands of the Philistines. The Philistines held the coastland. Judah held the highlands, so to speak, the mountainous area. and that bit in between. And so the valley of Sorak is right next to it. It's the right at the top of where the tribe of Dan, Benjamin, Judah all connect, but also the Philistines are still able to move in. Now, Machane Dan means the camp of Dan. And so it would seem that they settled there in that area. It's mentioned once more in chapter 18, verse 12. It's a place that the Danites no longer held at that point. The Philistines were not overcome. Judah took the edge to the boundary. And so the Danites move away from this area, and they move up all the way north to the north part of the country. Now here you can see the five major cities, Ekron, Gath, Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Gaza, and they're the five major cities of the Philistines. And it's where most of the trouble are centered. Now in chapter 14, we see Samson meeting the Philistines more head-on. Samson went to Timnah, or if you're reading this in the King James, it says Timnath, and that's just a textual variation, and he saw a woman in Timnah who was one of the daughters of the Philistines. So he came back and he told his father and mother, "I saw a woman at Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines, now therefore go get her as my wife." Now it shows that there is great interaction between them, and clearly all of the tribes are not keeping themselves separate, but they are becoming more Canaanite and becoming more paganized during this time, and particularly in the book of Judges we see that. Now Timnah is highly significant because we've encountered Timnah before in Genesis 38, where Judah, the son of Jacob, sees his daughter-in-law Tamar, who's twice widowed by his firstborn, Judah's firstborn, and she married Onan, his secondborn. Both of these are wicked, and so God kills them. And Judah then promises Tamar a third son, Shelah, but Judah wasn't honorable and doesn't give her a son. And so she covers herself, and Judah assumes she's a prostitute, a zonah. And he has sexual relationship with her, Genesis 38:15. Though when he recounts the story in verse 21, he calls her not a prostitute, but a shrine prostitute. And so he makes the whole situation a lot worse. This whole area is therefore a tainted area. Because here we are at Timnah again, and now with Samson. And again, there's the association of the prostitute. She's a beautiful woman, but all the alarm bells should be ringing. And they did for his parents. And they said, "Is there no woman among the daughters of your people, the tribe of Dan? Or from among all our peoples?" In other words, from all of the 12 tribes, that you have to take a wife of these uncircumcised Philistines, those people that are outside covenant. But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she's right in my eyes." He is blunt. Right in my eyes. That should ring a bell, an alarm bell at least for us. Because everyone does what is right in his own eyes. Judges 17:6, Judges 21:25. So he's not doing what is right in the eyes of the Lord. He is flouting the law, because you're not allowed to intermarry with the local population, Exodus 34:12, Deuteronomy 7. Yet Samson will not take no for an answer. And so he forces his way, and his parents didn't know it was from the Lord, because there was an occasion against the Philistines. And so at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel, and so it could have been seen as a political alliance. But Samson goes down to Timnah with his father and mother, and they came as far as the vineyards of Timnah. And behold, a young lion came roaring towards him. And so this most likely happens during the same time as the story of Micah and the Levite. So Judges 17 and 18, which is something that happens earlier, could well happen during this time, this gruesome story of the Levite and his concubine, and the civil war that takes place. So there's lots of unfaithfulness going on at this time. And so it shouldn't surprise us. And because of that, there's a curse upon Israel based on Deuteronomy 28, verses 43 and 44. And so it's clear. Anyway, many sermons find fault only with Samson, and that's a bit depressing because while he's not the best of the judges, he certainly is not the worst. Because by faith he stopped the mouths of lions. So he is connecting here in some way by trusting in God for his great strength. Now, not every deed of Samson is probably recorded. Here's another slide of the area. And so we have Eshtol and Sora by the camp of Danis, Machane Dan. And it's, as you can see, close to Ekron, which is one of the major Philistine cities, in Beit Shemesh, which comes up later. But by faith, and when we look at the faith component within his life, killing the young lion with his bare hands, clearly referenced in Hebrews 11, he tore the young lion like a little goat, or like a goat that is already prepared, slaying 30 Philistines. There's an interesting thought here, and it's just a thought. Are these the 30 companions who guarded Samson when he was supposed to get married? Josephus in the Antiquities of the Jews, book 5, chapter 8, paragraph 6, does seem to indicate that. By faith he caught the foxes, breaking the ropes, the new ropes, the bowstrings that were tied on him. And so there are moments of faith within his life, but sadly these are always denied, and that's a great pity. Now, I do want to focus for a minute on the riddle of Samson, because he is a bit of a wordsmith, if you like. Samson's desire for a Philistine woman, and the way he responds sounds rather crude. Yet at the same time, he has wordplays that he makes. And so here, it's the lion that he had killed. He then comes back to the lion, and he finds the honey in the carcass, Judges 14, 5 to 9. And at his wedding feast, he proposed this riddle based on the experience. And so he says, out of the ochel, something ma'achel, and out of the strong came something sweet. And so there's a word play that he makes here. Let me stay there for a second. And so there is some word play that he's making. The eater, the fierce lion, unexpected yield something to eat, the honey. Similarly, the strong, again, the fierce lion, produces something sweet, something soft and mellow. And so there are parallels being drawn here. Now, we know the story, the Philistines are unable to resolve the riddle. They pressure Samson's wife, threatening to burn her and the family. She then pressures Samson, who eventually answers the truth, and enraged that she then tells it on, and he becomes angry with the deceptors and those who threatened his wife. He therefore attacks the Philistines in Ashkelon, and that sparks a cycle of violence. Samson's father-in-law then gives his wife away to one of his friends. And then Samson burns down the crops, chapter 15, 4 to 5. The Philistines then burn his wife and his father-in-law in the next verse. So it's a tit-for-tat horrific descent into not just chaos, but horrific violence. But the riddle does indicate that he's not just an uneducated or somebody who is weak. But his weakness is really his impulsiveness. But looking at these kind of word puns that he makes, it clearly is indicating that he is a little bit smarter than we often give him credit for. With the jawbone, the lechi of a donkey, chamor, chamor upon chamorim, chamorayim, chamoratim, sorry, chamoratim, with the jawbone, lechi of a donkey, chamor. Now, how do you translate this? It is almost impossible, the repetitiveness of the word chamor, but used in different forms of both donkey and heap, or heaps. It creates a memorable kind of wordplay. The Young Literal Translation has this, and Samson said, with a jawbone of an ass upon asses, with a jawbone of the ass, I've smitten 1,000 men. And so they make that clear wordplay, and they keep that sense of chamor as donkey or as an ass intact. And I think that's a better translation. It's a wordplay that highlights what he's trying to do and say. In my sanctified imagination, it is almost as if Samson is saying, with the jawbone of a donkey, I heap donkeys upon donkeys with the jawbone of a donkey. And it is a little Minoic that he makes a memorable play, but it is something that we don't see in the English when we read, with a jawbone of a donkey, heap upon heaps with a jawbone of the donkey. The wordplay is a little bit lost. Not only that, in verse 17, he then goes out to a place called Ramat Lechi, the height of a jawbone, meaning the hill bone, the hill of a jawbone of a donkey. And so linking this wordplay with this whole triumph that he has. Now this trouble that he has is not just at this point. One of the other areas of faith within his life is when he took down the city gate. Now the city gate here is 2 meters wide, 4 meters in total height, so at the center. Now Samson, when he went to Gaza, saw a harlot there. He went into her when it was told the men of Gaza, saying, Samson has come here. They surrounded the place, lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. And they kept quiet all night, saying, let us wait until morning light, and then we'll kill him. And Samson lay until midnight, and at midnight he arose, and took hold of the doors of the city gate and the two posts, and pulled them up along with the bars, and he put them on his shoulder and carried them to the top of the mountain, which is opposite Hebron. So, how heavy were those doors? I don't know, but those are city gate doors, so they are really heavy. There would have been a lot of weight in it. But he doesn't just remove the doors, he also removes the door post and the bars. He uproots it all the way out of this whole structure. And then he takes them from Gaza to near Hebron. Now that's 60 kilometers. So there's an amazing amount of strength here, but it's by faith. And that really is something that we forget. Now it's through Samson's fault, and the consequences of neglecting his faith is clearly seen in chapter 16 when Delilah seduces, manipulates, and discovers through that his secret of his strength. He meets this woman in the valley of Sorek, and her name is Delilah. Now, Delilah is not called a harlot or a prostitute. Many sermons do state that, but the Bible doesn't indicate that. And so Delilah does weaken his heart and his spirit, that's true. And so what did she do? Who knows? But we often hear things that are not quite what is in the text. What Delilah does do is cheat him by proposing to the five lords of the Philistines to seduce him and find out where his strength lies. Now, the five cities of Gaza, and so these are the five Philistine cities, all had one individual ruler over them. So these five lords each pay 1,100 pieces of silver. Now, that's a royal reward, and with that, she's willing to seduce him. She persistently asked about the source of his strength and framing it as a test of his love in verse 6, 10, and 13, and pretending to be hurt. Oh, you don't love me, you know, kind of language in verse 15. And she pretends to be concerned about his safety, claiming that the Philistines will attack if he doesn't reveal his weakness. Now, how does that work? I don't know. But, yeah. He is initially able to withstand it and gives false answers or untruthful answers. Finally, exhausted by her nagging, Samson reveals the truth. His strength comes from being a Nazarite, and his hair cannot be cut. Even though he's broken all the other rules of the Nazarite already, that one he has kept. Now, Delilah is guilty, but so is Samson. Samson chose to reveal and chose Philistine women and other prostitutes beside Delilah, who's not a prostitute, but other Philistine women. If there's one verse that really talks about his life, it's found in 1 John 2, verse 16. All that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life. It's not from God, it's from the world. And that's exactly his life. He filled it with the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and by now he's boasted in his power, in his strength. And so, because of that, Samson is captured, his head is shaven, and the seven locks of his hair, she wakes him, and he presumes that the Lord would be with him. So, Judges 16, verses 18 to 21. Samson doesn't realize that the Lord has departed from him. It is at this point that the Philistines capture him, they seize him, they gouge out his eyes, and brought him down to Gaza, bound him with bronze chains. And he was used as a grinder in a prison. And so this would indicate that he would be attached to a mill, and he would be forced to walk around as a donkey, pushing the mill into a grinding position. And it's during this time that some of his hair is starting to regrow. And I suspect at this time, that Samson realizes that he has broken the vow and he needs to renew the vow. He acknowledges his sin and repents. Though it isn't quite in our text. Now the Philistines in verse 24, they are very happy. When the people saw him, they praised their God, that's Dagon. For they said, our God has given our enemy into our hands, even the destroyer of our country, who has slain many of us. So they sing in praise and you know, of Dagon, who's now allowed him to be captured. Samson's defeat, though, is not because Dagon was stronger, but because he disobeyed God's command. In verse 25, there is the final wordplay being made in his life. I don't know if I... Yes, I do. And it's, again, a little bit of a fascination. It so happened, verse 25, as they were high in spirits, that means that they were drunk, He said, call for Samson that he may entertain or amuse us. Now the word for entertain or amuse, yeshechak, comes from the root shechak. However, with the Hebrew, because it's not pointed at this point, there's no little dots and dashes underneath it, it can be read slightly different. And so if we move the dots a little bit around, it could mean the word crush. Call for Samson that he may crush us. And so that would be just by looking at the plain text and not the traditional reading of it, because this word can be read either or. Now, it's always translated as entertain or amuse, that's true. But really, when we do the other reading, which is in the text, it allows foreshadowing. Call for Samson that he may crush us. And so while they were calling for the amusement to happen, Samson is able to read that he may crush us. At this point, the wordplay then becomes fulfilled in verse 26. Samson says to the boy who was holding his hand, let me feel the pillars on which the house, that's the temple of Dagon, rests, that I may lean against them. Samson is now in an utter state of vulnerability. He needs a young boy to hold his hand, to guide him, to lead him. He's unable to see. He is broken, blind, and he's a dependent man. Where once he was a solitary force of dynamite, now he has to rely on a child, for guidance. Samson's leadership was marked by isolation and refusal to collaborate. Unlike Ehud and Deborah or Jephthah or Gideon. But he now is forced to lean upon others. Now when he does, he prays and he says, Yahweh or O Lord God Adonai, I pray, remember me and strengthen me just this time, O God Elohim, that I may at once be avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes. It's not the greatest prayer, but it's interesting that in this prayer, he's not referencing his personal strength. He's not referencing he is making a plea. I pray, remember, is some of the translations are slightly different, like please remember me, but the better translation is, I pray, remember. I pray, strengthen. And so it is a contrite prayer of faith. And so it is now back in humble state. And he invokes God's name and two titles. He uses the covenant name, Yahweh. And so it's the God of Israel. But he also says Adonai and Elohim, Lord and God. So he covers the whole gamut in that sense. Samson then grasps the two middle pillars of the house. And he braces himself against them with one on one, the other one on the other. And Samson said, and he's continuing his prayer, let me die with the Philistines. And he bends with all his might so that the house, the temple, fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead whom he killed and his death were more than those he killed in life. Sometimes this is seen as suicide. I don't see it that way. I think it's a profound act of sacrificial choice of giving over a life. The Philistines had mocked him. He now turns to God. And so it is that selfless, contrite prayer. I think it's a selfless act of faith that he now expresses. Samson is then buried in Judges 16, verse 31. Then his brothers and his father's household came down, took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtol in the tomb of Manoah his father. Thus he had judged Israel for 20 years. It's not just his brothers, but his extended family. They must have kept tabs and heard what happened. They took out the body of the ruin of the temple, brought him back to holy ground, so to speak, to his own country for burial. Now, he judged Israel for 20 years. Did he judge Israel? Not much to indicate that he did. There are five observations, I think, that the book depicts Judges. The book of Judges depicts Samson as a figure filled with contradictions. On the one hand, he has God's backing. He's an unstoppable force. Yet it's a little child that has to lead him in the end. It's the women of the Philistine clan that consistently lead him astray. And so he's a cautionary tale of a man who doesn't listen. There's a fascinating duality in the relationship with sight. On the one hand, with the lust of his eyes, at the end, they take out his eyes. There's a bit of an absurdity with him, Samson's actions and apparent desires. He, despite repeatedly seeking out and engaging the Philistines, particularly the Philistine women among them, the woman of Timnah, who became his wife, the unnamed prostitute, Judges 16, and ultimately Delilah, in the end, he prays not to be captured by the Philistines, while his whole time he was captured by the Philistines. And so there's this absurdity within it. In Judges 15, he claims to be a servant of God. And if there's one thing that's clear, he did everything to ignore that. He married the wrong people. He had drunken orgies with the 30 Philistine groomsmen for his wedding, so to speak. He's a complex character. There's no doubt about that. I think the thing that we do need to ponder, though, throughout all of this, he remains a servant of God. He remains a man of faith. Though he wasn't always faithful. And so he serves as a cautionary tale to all of us. That we not only need to be men and women of faith, but also faithful. Not walking in the ways of the world, but obeying the calling that God has placed upon our life. Well, there you go. I have gone a little bit over time, but I hope you'll forgive me for that.
That's good, Paul. Thank you very much. If we take a break now for about 15, 20 minutes, to come back about 10 to 9, thereabouts, wrap up some key points, some questions and comments. That'll be a good time.
Sounds good.
For those that need to leave us at this point, Paul, what should they be looking for next week?
Next week we are looking at the story of Micah.
Mm-hmm.
And so Micah is in the next chapters. Let me just pull it up. It's chapter 17 to 18. It's Micah's idolatry. And the tribe of Dan that is now moving away from this area up north. And so they're seeking their own territory. And so those two chapters are key in that, chapter 17 and 18.